coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Happy debate night, come to think of it. There is a presidential debate on tonight. My old and good friend and former co-host Stephen Bishop texted me a while ago, like, you watching the debate tonight? And I was like, I'll probably be watching it in rerun because I'm live. But tonight on the show, we have our own debate. In the very beginning, one of my favorite debates. And that is the debate about the great bard himself, the so-called bard, I'll call him, the pseudo-bard, the man known as William Shakespeare, or that we know, rather, as William Shakespeare. If William Shakespeare that we know is William Shakespeare, that's the question posed by the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship. Our guest in the first segment is Dr. Earl Showerman. He is the current president of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship. He's graduated from Harvard College and the University of Michigan Medical School, practiced emergency medicine in Southern Oregon for 30 years, and after retiring in 2003, enrolled to study Shakespeare, and over the past two decades has presented and published numerous scholarly papers on a variety of topics, including the Greek dramatic sources of Hamlet, Macbeth, Winter's Tale, Pericles, Much Ado About Nothing, and many more. I am very excited to be going to the upcoming Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference in Denver. Welcome to the show, the president of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, Dr. Eric Showerman. How are you doing this evening?
Well, I am the first Earl of Ashland, Chris. I have to make you aware of that. So that I've worn that title since 2015 when we had our first conference here. And in that year, we had the production of Richard III starring Jamie Newcomb, who was a local star and an Oxfordian. So we were really eating our cake then. That was in 2005, so almost 20 years ago now. We've had a number of other conferences in our Ashland, Oregon, where the festival is. So it's been a wonderful part of my life for 50 years. I moved here in 74, lived in Ashland, walking distance to the theater. And after having what I would call transpersonal experiences in some plays, particularly I remember The Winter's Tale, how shocking the statue scene was, and with the beautiful Pachelbel, Cannon, and Dee playing, there was sobbing throughout the audience. And you knew that you were in a new kind of spiritual practice, or a very ancient one that goes back way back to the Greeks. In fact, that scene does come from Euripides, Alcestis. Mm. I wrote a paper about that because it lived with me forever. Oh, the fearfulness of an assassination of Banquo in Macbeth, when even the hairs on my ER doc's head rose because of the dramatic horror of an assassination like that, cutting somebody's throat. It compelled me to pay attention and to realize all these parallels in the great tragedies and in certainly many of the best comedies that show evidence of Greek influence. And I heard a lecture from an undergraduate back in 2002 at Concordia up in Portland by a man named Andy Wirth. He was a junior that year. He wrote a paper that was later quoted by Stanley Wells, the chairman of the Birthplace Trust, at a conference in Europe, saying, yeah, Andy Wirth is right about the fact that the Greek anthology influenced Sonnet 153 and 154. But then he's an Oxfordian, so we could ignore his anything personal. But what Andy wrote was so compelling and so well done, it inspired me to look more deeply myself into Greek influences in Shakespeare. So truly, I came to this inspired by a young man who showed me a fresh look of what might be possible. And that went on for 20 years now.
Well, and you know, that brings up a question real quick, good doctor. And I use the word doctor because you are a doctor of medicine. And you know, a lot of people would immediately throw this into the bin of conspiracy theory. The idea that Shakespeare, and you know, feel free to throw it in that bin if you like, folks, because what we're going to get into toward the end of this is, what is the vested interest in Shakespeare maintaining to be Shakespeare? Right. You know, and right. and sadly, what it does come down to is, yes, money. You know, much like we have talked about on this show whenever we have our good friend Daniel Duke on, who is related to Jesse James and has proof of the fact that Jesse James lived his life out here in Texas. He did not die in that town. That town has a very vested interest in yes. the house where Jesse James died. They have a total vested interest. So we'll be getting into some of the conspiracy and why this information and these facts of quite literal detective work, why they are pushed down and not accepted by the academic society as it stands. So I use the word doctor very pointedly and necessarily because you are a medical doctor who has gone down this realm of research, you know, and there are a lot of people who would be like, my God, I can't believe this man of medicine would do something like this.
I'll tell you a good story about that now. I was invited by a group of ER physicians that have an annual conference in Yosemite Park, which I had never visited. And I had to think of a topic to present because the sponsor knew I liked Shakespeare. He wanted me to talk on Shakespeare. Well, I thought Shakespeare's medical knowledge, pretty good topic. Mm-hmm. I've heard a talk on that. Let me go to the library. And fortunately, Ashland had the Haddon Library, which has literally thousands of books on Shakespeare. And they had about five or six different texts on Shakespeare's medical knowledge. The first was 150 years ago, Dr. Bucknell wrote a magnificent book describing all the features of Shakespeare's knowledge of the Galenic and the other aspects of medicine, was familiar with the Hippocratic principles, with managing infectious diseases, and was quite remarkable, not only because he reflected on, with accuracy, the practices of the time, which were rather controversial and based on a rather faulty 2,000-year-old model, and looked at all these features of including infectious diseases, a lot of descriptions of syphilis, among other things. And it was just remarkable how deep and knowledgeable, and how everybody suggested he had to have read this book or this book or this book or this translation of Hippocrates. And you realize he was very well read in medicine. And then there were other summary books that had been published since that time over the years that reinforce a recent dictionary, 700 of Shakespeare's medical terms, current medical terms was there. So the idea that he was knowledgeable about medicine matched very well his knowledge of the law, his knowledge of seamanship, his knowledge of foreign languages, including yeah. Latin and Italian and French, and now I'm pretty sure Greek as well. So, you know, you've got a lot of reasons to keep looking after this stuff. So,
well, yeah. and that is something that we, as I told you before the show, you would hear me use the phrase, if I was a DA, I wouldn't take the case. Most of what we know about the man we know as William Shakespeare is very cursory knowledge. We have no actual surviving original manuscripts in his handwriting. Very few examples of handwriting from William Shakespeare. And even if that is the William Shakespeare that we're talking about, they don't seem to match up. How is it that somebody who would have been, you know, basically a Middle English cabbage farmer almost in education status, how is it that somebody who isn't of royal descent or isn't of educated descent able to write all of these things, able to have all of this very intimate knowledge, once again, not only of law and how it operates, but of royal families and how they operate, the drama within them, the various places, as we've mentioned whenever we've had Catherine Children on, the grove of cypress trees that is mentioned in Romeo and Juliet. You know, where it's like you would have had
probably plane trees.
Yeah, yeah.
There's been some further investigation. No, but I understand what you're saying. The Italian context is so rich and so deep.
Huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would have you would have had to have traveled there to have known these things. So the fact of an average person or person of even average education traveling that far away from home would have been almost unheard of during those times.
Well, as you know, the properties in Stratford-upon-Avon that are claimed to be part of his family legacy, where his son and daughter-in-law, I mean, his daughter and son-in-law lived, and where his wife came from and her family, the Arden Farm and the birthplace. And the only authentic building in that entire village is Holy Trinity Church. And even there, you've got a problem because they scan the slab where he's supposedly been buried. Mm. There's nothing there. There's nothing under the slab.
Wow.
Yeah. Don't move these stones. There's nothing. There was no skull. I mean, they scanned it looking for body parts, bones. There's nothing they could see. It was too small for a human being to be in there. So where is the body? Now, the family is buried in that region there that's marked. And there's this the monument on the wall, which is cryptic. It's very cryptic what's written there. And Alexander Waugh suggested that what's written on that wall monument is actually referencing some of the poets that are buried in Poets' Corner in Westminster, which he speculates is actually where the author, Edward de Vere, if you're one of us, is probably actually buried. So the corpse of Mr. Will, we don't know where it is. It's certainly not in that little area they've got marked out. So even that is part of the myth that's been built, and it's been going on for a couple hundred years. And, you know, there are trusts of the royal household, and King Charles has been their, you know, chair for years and years. So we're not going to unseat him. However, the animated conversation is brilliant. And I think there's a degree of envy which poisons the waters of those who want to look at us without the most critical lens, you know. I mean, for real people who are interested in the subject and know the history of the controversy and how people are representing it today, Elizabeth Winkler's book, Shakespeare Was a Woman, and that's just a joke. Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies, How Doubting the Bard Became the Biggest Taboo in Literature. And I think you'll see that there's a taboo here, which then makes it a mystery.
Yeah.
What is behind the resistance to it? And today, I would say it's at least partly fear of economic loss. If you actually identify Hedy & Vallentin as the home of the author. But I do think there were many good reasons for why the authorship was concealed and why it was there was an allonym used for a man who had affiliations with the theater. And then you could create the myth posthumously in 1623 when you put out the folio and the Sweet Swan of Avon and Thy Stratford Monument, the only two phrases in that entire frontis part of the first folio that attaches to Stratford. And even there, Alexander Waugh said, well, no, Sweet Swan of Avon means the Avon is Avondom, which is, you know, one of the castles, Hampton Court on the banks of the Thames, where there were many swans, and where Eliza and James saw plays performed at court, the plays of Shakespeare, no doubt. So that even that might be a misnomer. So the actual documentary evidence and those six signatures, the Birthplace Trust itself, Chris, has recently changed their website. Not all these signatures may be Will Shakespeare's signatures. Some may have been signed by court clerks. And that change in language was brought about by research done by Oxfordian Matt Hutchinson, who is going to be presenting at the conference.
Oh, and he's talking about,
you know, a different subject altogether. But he's coming in by video, so you'll have to talk to him about that. But that's very cool that we can have a breakthrough that even changes their website.
Well, and it's the fact of, A, research does not happen in a vacuum. And B, research can be a long time coming. It's not like, it's not like we're garnering a whole lot of new DNA evidence when it comes to William Shakespeare, things like that. But when it comes to the forensic ways in which we look at documents, when it comes to the forensic ways that we break these things down, those methods and methodologies are improving constantly and all the time.
Yeah.
So
no, you're talking about, you know, forensic handwriting analysis. Yeah. We're saying the recent research we were talking about earlier about Ed Audley and that Roger Stridman has been publishing on. And he's proving that the Earl of Oxford's handwriting annotated these editions, these brief editions of Cassius Dio that were from the 16th century. At that time, printing included a 2-inch margin built for people who, for the reader to write commentaries.
Yeah.
And so the highlighted commentaries that are associated with these 2,000 marginal annotations in this history, those that are about Antony and Cleopatra and Julius Caesar have a remarkable concurrence with the passages within Shakespeare in terms of imagery and sequence or whatever it is. And Roger's doing a deep dive on trying to prove that the author of Shakespeare's Roman tragedies
yeah.
had to have read this volume and that he annotated it in Latin and Greek writing in an original Greek book from the 16th century.
Wow.
So if we've got Oxford being able to read and write Greek and in the ancient text, then he is, and that's from the second century. And he would have loved the drama. He had Plutarch in translation. He would have definitely had Lucian. He had Plato. Yeah. We don't know what kind of a translation. So he was fascinated by, he had Heliodorus dedicated to him, the greatest of all the Greek romances that the playwrights used all through the 1580s. They built their plots on Heliodorus. And Oxford is the one that sponsored the translation by Thomas Bedingfield, I think. But anyway, it was, you know, he was in the mix with the Greeks. And so any proof that would be something that would add from the other side the concurrence of his capabilities and interest in Greek text. I mean, it's a rare find. Roger could be a decade doing this kind of work, and I fully think he might. This is the most exciting primary research he's had, given that he was the guy that looked at Oxford's Bible 20 years ago in the Folger Shakespeare Library and determined all those manicules and underlineations and slight annotations were affiliated with lines from Shakespeare's biblical, you know, commentaries. Mm-hmm. So he's the perfect person to be doing this research. So synchronicity of all this coming together right now, to me, is like, it's magical. It's like, we're deep into this, Chris, and I love it, and it keeps me alive.
Well, once again, it's amazing. And once again, there is a political debate going on tonight. And like, I love telling people,
I've got it recorded back here.
It was one of those, like I normally tell people, I could probably put my money behind a political candidate if I believed in that as much as I do things like this. I believe in work like this so much more because it opens the conversation and is supposed to open the conversation for humanity. And when you start looking at the idea, especially with English literature, with any real liturgical background in that kind of way, it is the way that a culture expresses itself. It is the way that a culture is seen. And it's very interesting to control that dialogue, when it comes to Shakespeare.
It's an epistemological issue, a teaching issue, epistemological.
Yeah.
And we have a champion of that discourse in a new author named Michael Dudley. He's on our board, and he will be giving a presentation during our conference. And his book is The Shakespeare Authorship Question and Philosophy. And he's pointing out all the issues of the ethical consequences of the way this problem is being approached. And this is people who are deeply interested in serious research and analysis are considered to be conspiracy, you know, minded idiots, flat earthers, and worse, you know. And the degree of disparagement varies, but Holocaust denial has not been used very often, but it has been used. And so the attempt to marginalize this organization, these people who are investigating this, it's hard to, however, go against Sir Derek Jacobi and Mark Rylance and other Keanu Reeves, among others, and Walt Whitman or Mark Twain.
Yeah.
Courageous writers who knew the craft of theater. Robin Williams, a great comedian. Robin Williams, he was on our side. You know, so we have John Paul Stevens on the more serious side. We have a champions of the questioning. That's all we're asking is the question and get engaged and how much more deeply you can appreciate a work. If you have a little moment behind the author's mask, if you have an imago of an author and his life experience to enrich what you're seeing and hearing. You'll hear things and see things others won't see.
Well, so, I think that is a very astute analysis of this situation, because when you start, I mean, there's probably a very few people other than Shakespeare that have been studied as much as Shakespeare. Like people's literal doctorate theses are written on Shakespeare, stuff like that. And I think that is where some of the kerfuffle comes in, Doctor, is the idea of, you know, there have been some foundational thoughts when it comes to Shakespeare and the way that Shakespeare was written and the way that it influenced the way that, you know, poetry is written, things like that.
Because the Oxford University Press, the new Shakespeare that came out in 2017, claimed that there were, among others, 17 co-authors of 11 of Shakespeare's plays, or was it the reverse? 17 plays, 11 co-authors, including Anonymous. Okay, but it did not include Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, on their list of co-authors. These are based on irrelevant and incapable of doing scientific analysis, language in the investigations that look at word adjacency profiles or feminine endings, and they try to establish a stylistic parameters for somebody out of a very small database on someone who's written a huge database of plays, most of which are missing. So you have an inadequate data supply to give a good conclusion. So they made vast conclusions based on very weak data in a complex, you know, stylometric analysis that defies logic. And they're in conflict with other people who say, no, oh, the dating itself is way off, because it is widely assumed, but widely there's no document to prove it. So you have co-authorship and dating, two grave uncertainties out there. So it's like they're deconstructing Shakespeare on some level. On the other hand, I think that the Earl of Oxford is a good candidate for having written almost all the canon, and maybe with a scriptorium helping him at different times, or him writing pseudonymously under others with his assistants, John Lilly, or, you know, Robert Greene, or Thomas Nash, or any of the literary circle that were dedicating works to him, that were receiving support from him, particularly Lilly, who had the contract at Blackfriars in the early 1580s, where Oxford's boys and other boys' companies performed. And Oxford is thought to have written plays for those boys and performed at court, one of them being the history of Agamemnon and Ulysses, put on in 1584. I'm pretty sure that was an early version of Troilus and Cressida, because that was at the time that England was about to go to war with Spain. And it's a kind of an anti-war polemic on some level. I'm going to have to write that in a good paper to prove that. But I think that those are uncertainties that are being introduced in the controversy of co-authorship is all over the place. But I do think that there was a unifying spirit that whose name is the one name at the top of most of those plays, probably wrote the vast amount of it over about a 20-year history of writing and rewriting. And we know Hamlet was rewritten massively. Now, here's the very, very cool thing, Chris. 200 years after the publication of the first folio, somebody finds in a library a copy of Hamlet that is half the length of the original Hamlet that's published in the first folio. The first quarto was 1603, and the second quarto was 1604, and the folio 1623. The first quarto was not the one that is that's on the record of having been published 1603. One copy in the entire world existed, and it was only found 200 years after Shakespeare's death. Yeah. So I'm going to be talking about that in my talk in Denver, that the miracle of one edition surviving, and then we can talk about it.
Well, and once again, the idea that somebody like Edward de Vere, somebody who is of noble upbringing, somebody who had through his uncle a very classical education, which would have meant education in Latin, education in Greek.
We know his whole day routine of dancing French, archery, you know, and then English, and then translation, and on Sundays Greek. No, we have the catalog of how Burley and his precepts, that whole thing. Yeah, clearly he was in the center of political development and power during that critical time, especially in the 1560s and late 1560s. 1860s when Mary Queen of Scots was afoot, and there was a Northern Rebellion. He was part of that campaign up there against the nobles that wanted to put Mary on the throne of England. And, you know, he was mixed up in all sorts of stuff as a teenager at the center of action and politics and literature and development. He was at Gray's Inn. He was at Cambridge. He was at Oxford. He was tutored by Thomas Smith and other really famous people, scholars of that era, who said, I got nothing else to teach him. He's on his way. His uncle, Arthur Golding, you know, was like marveling at his incredible interest, and he dedicated his Trogus Pompeius to him when he was 14 years old. He said, yeah, you're really good at reading, and this is a really cool history. And that Trogus is probably a source for Titus Andronicus, okay? So Oxford gets a dedication when he's 14, and you know, 20 years later, he turns it into a great tragedy. He puts Tamora's based on a character that is clearly described in Golding's translation.
Trogus.
Yeah, very cool.
Even the idea of literary
connections that he had within his family. Mildred Cecil had all these Greek editions. She was a famous Greek translator. They were connected to all the great translators, the Gray's Inn, all these Latin translations that were published off Seneca and other many writers. It was a hotbed of translation, and the primary patrons were Elizabeth, Leicester, Cecil, and Oxford. It was four of them pushing all those translation projects forward.
Wow.
And so there was a firestorm of intellectual activity hovering all through his early youth. It was just an amazing time.
Let's get into real quick, because we've got you for about 30 more minutes. Let's start exploring the whys. Why would an earl in the royal court who is writing all of these plays, why would he need a nom de plume? Why wouldn't he want to, you know, proud peacock that around, so to speak? Like, hey, look at all these plays I'm pinning, you know. How does the nom de plume start, I guess, and how do we get to the point of confusion and kerfuffle with it?
All right. We're in 1586. Let's just say that. Let's put us there in 1586. The queen calls the Earl of Oxford in, and she says, okay, I know you're not in great financials right now. You've spent a lot of money supporting the little theaters and the acting companies and all that, and you don't have enough money to get along, but I'm going to give you a grant of £1,000 a year, but no one can know what you're doing when you're writing these plays and making me an important person and my family and the history plays, and you do this for us. You've been doing already pretty good out there in this with the Queensmen, but I think you could do this well, but you have to stay anonymous. No one can know about the money I'm giving you, and no one can know about what attach your name in any way to these works. And that's the condition of this annuity grant. That grant was renewed every year for 18 years by Elizabeth and again by King James. I believe this was a silent royal proclamation from the queen herself. I do not want the people to know that the history plays you're writing that make my ancestor, Henry VII, you know, the one who deposed and wiped out Richard III, the great arch villain of the Yorkists, that he's my grandfather. Yeah. And that everything that came good to England came because we got rid of that tyrant, Richard, okay? Because the historians did it for Dad, you know? Yeah. Look, Henry VIII had, that Hollins had write these chronicles and Halls write these chronicles that made Richard look bad. Now, you got a source over here.
Yep.
Do that for me, okay? Let's see. How about make me a hero? Give me a Henry V, you know, or Henry IV. You know, show me a series of English men becoming heroic and in battle good, you know? And so he does. He's got that going, but he can't get his name on it. It's state propaganda.
Yeah.
So, Chris, I'm going to tell you right now, I think one of the very first plays he wrote in that vein for the queen to allegorize and to point a historical precedent that supported her realm was Hamlet, the 1603 first quarto that was discovered 200 years later, is the one referred to in 1589. In Robert Greene's Menaphon, Thomas Nash writes the introduction addressed to the gentlemen of Oxford and Cambridge universities, and he refers to why, you know, English Seneca will give you whole Hamlets, whole handfuls of tragical speeches. And then he goes on in this euphuistic novel, but he mentions a Hamlet, whole Hamlets of handfuls of tragical speeches around Hamlet. And then in 1603 and in 04 and 06, I mean, yeah, 1593, 94, and 96, there are references to Hamlet productions affiliated with Shakespeare. So there's an early Hamlet.
Interesting.
Which, what was it? Well, if there was an early Hamlet in the 1580s and there's a more finished Hamlet in 1604, which is when the next change occurred, that was a 10-year revision. Okay. I mean, that was a doubling the size of it, improving the poetry, all those exquisite soliloquies, they're all part of that second quarto. The first quarto is a little bit cruder, okay? But the one thing that's true in both is the Burleigh's precepts, they're exact. So their first quarto, some might thought it was a bad quarto, the Ur-Hamlet, a memorial reconstruction. No, it was a first version written in that vein for the Queen to allegorize the conviction of Mary, Queen of Scots, who colluded against, conspired against Elizabeth, tried to have her murdered, and also colluded against her husband, Lord Darnley, 20 years earlier. And the Earl of Bothwell is accused of having killed Darnley, and then she marries Bothwell like Claudius, kills King Hamlet, and marries Gertrude. So the parallels of the historical events that were going on, and the scholars who have seen Hamlet as an allegorical tragedy, that it does reflect on Mary, Queen of Scots. And so that's where it gets really interesting. And you can go back 20 years even and look at play produced in the 1567, 68 era when Mary was deposed and then accused of all these terrible things. Yeah. And the propaganda campaign against her probably included a Tudor interlude called Orestes. And a number of scholars says Orestes was about the crisis caused by Mary, Queen of Scots, colluding with her lover to kill her husband and then marrying him and then being run off. And then she gets thrown in prison. She miscarries. She has to abdicate. And then she escapes a year later and spends the rest of her life in England under you know, custodial care.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating story, like a soap opera at both ends of it. It's quite amazing. And I think in Hamlet, in that play, and in the Tudor interlude, Orestes, which I referred to here, are definite clues that lead you in the direction of recognizing this is giving, you know, advice to Elizabeth that she was justified in imprisoning, basically, and then executing Mary, Queen of Scots for conspiring to have her murdered and have a Spanish invasion and all this. So then the Spanish invasion does come the next year. And so it's very timely to have a play that shows that defends Elizabeth's decision to execute a royal, you know, crowned woman, you know, even though she had, abdicated. So it's the mix of politics. Now, there's definitely politics that are really fun, excuse me, to get into this, in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
Because the whole Bottom and Titania romance and the love potion is all an allegory about the pursuit of the Duke of Alençon and his ambassador, Semier, to marry Queen Elizabeth around 1580. There is a wonderful book called Bottom Thou Art Translated that points out that this is a hysterical allegory of how Elizabeth is like Titania and the French Duke is like Bottom. The parallels in that romance, and it's hysterical. If you were at court and you had any idea of how this allegory was working, you would have been losing urinary control. You'd laugh so hard. It is such a good play when you see the allegory about mocking the queen's obsession because of the love potions that the Semier was accused of using on her, that she looked 15 years younger and she'd have these Frenchmen in her bedroom unchaperoned repeatedly over and over again, sneaking in and out of England a couple times without his brother's permission, the little Duke, you know. But he didn't make it with her. And finally, he went home and then they went off to war for her and then died of a broken heart at 29 when he was a military failure, you know. She wore black for months afterwards to mourn the Duke. It was all a show. She was putting on a show. And then 10 years later, Shakespeare writes a marvelous Midsummer Night's Dream comedy about this. And she would have really appreciated it because she was subtle and she would have been very bemused by this. She wouldn't have been offended by it at all because It's so forgivably beautiful. It's the greatest comedy, you know. But if you see the political allegory of the French romance, it enriches your appreciation, because a low-read person like Shakespeare could never have gotten away with making the queen look like Titania in a time when she was still alive. It was published in 1598, years before she passed. So, you know, he got away with it. He had artistic license.
That is something that we have brought up numerous times, is that, you know, the crown was, they were not bemoaned by beheading. Let's put it that way. It wasn't hard for them to behead somebody. Didn't matter if you had money, if you were connected. It's the royal crown. If they said off with your head, so be it. So if this author, just random rabble person from the Shire out there, is writing all of these stories that are hitting pretty close to home when it comes to the royal families and the way that they are. Once again, it seems as though these things would have been written with some kind of permission. Otherwise, why is this dude still walking the street?
Yeah,
you know,
well, because he was the only one not called in for investigation, you know, after the Richard II production that was put on the eve of the Essex Rebellion. Other members of the company had to account for this, but Shakespeare, the author, was never called in. I mean, Ben Jonson was in prison 2 or 3 times for various things that he wrote, and Thomas Kidd, and he was tortured and died young, and you know, Chapman went to jail. Virtually every other playwright at that time spent time in the Tower, you know, or in some other lonely prison, or some were literally tortured or disappeared. Nash's books were all burned, which is why we only have one copy of Menaphon. That's the other one miracle that survived. That Robert Greene's book that Nash wrote an introduction to, that refers to that early Hamlet, so that we know it's topical. I mean, Jeffrey Bullock, David Bevington, and John Carrigan, all great Shakespeare scholars. The early Hamlet was topical, Mary Queen of Scots and what was happening. And I have an original argument that I'm going to present. Now, I'm not going to tell your listeners about, Chris, and you won't know about this until we get there, but I'm calling it the beer barrel bunghole theory.
Okay.
Beer barrel bunghole. Now, there's in Act 5 of Hamlet, holding up the skull of Yorick, Hamlet thinks, you know, Alexander lived, Alexander died, Alexander turned to dust. You think Alexander looks like this and smells like this? Alexander, you know, turned to dust, dust to loam, loam to this and that. Why not? That Alexander might be forming a plug for a beer barrel bunghole. They refer to the beer barrel bunghole twice in this passage. The answer to that question of why the beer barrel bunghole, we will find out in Denver. I'm not going to tell you yet, sir. There's a historical precedent we've got going here.
Well, let's kind of start exploring and picking apart, because one of the things that you have written about is the Greek influence in Shakespeare's works, and that especially goes to speak to, once again, the classical education of somebody like Edward de Vere, who would have been familiar with, you know, the works like Lysistrata and things like that, which would have rang very, very heavily inside of his work, especially some of the messages that he was bringing across. So, where do we see the bridge between those classical works like that and them being reflected in the works of the Bard?
Well, let's start with Hamlet, since that's the one that seems to get most of our interest right now, and we're going to go to do a deep dive on that. Gilbert Murray, writing for the British Academy in 2014 on Hamlet and Orestes, A Study in Types, gives the most compelling argument of anyone ever on why Shakespeare clearly was making reference to the works of Aeschylus's Oresteia and to Euripides' Orestes drama, and that he tied all number of association. I mean, you have main burial rites, you have revenge tragedy, you have all the qualities and characters that where the son comes back and, you know, kills the mother and the lover, just like, you know, Hamlet ultimately in his story. But the character of the individuals, of the parallels between Orestes and how they both came by boat back. They're both thought to have been dead. They both end up at a memorial service for, you know, that brings them together in some new, unique way. He parallels all these things that are quite remarkable. This is not in Saxo or in Belfort's translation. It must come from a Greek original, but we know Shakespeare didn't read Greek, so we really can't explain it. Maybe there's some kind of archetypal transmission. He was a true believer in some kind of mystical transmission of themes, types of typologies and all this. And, you know, beautifully written thing, but he gave the most compelling arguments. And so it provoked responses, and that traditional scholars repeatedly throughout the 20th century said, no, 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 he didn't refer to the Greek plays at all. He couldn't have read them. They were published in England and all this sort of stuff. And so, no, he couldn't, you know, we must ignore that. He learned about Greek drama from Plutarch or from Ovid. That's what they'll give you excuses for. However, there are others who saw otherwise. And Louis Schleiner, a professor here in America, wrote about the Orestia. And he says, you know, I am so convinced that the scenes between Hamlet and Horatio and Orestes and Pylades at the grave sites, the parallels there are so compelling. And think of it. We really shouldn't think of Hamlet as an Oedipal character. He's far more likely to kill his mother than to have sex with her. And it's true. He's far more Orestian than he is like Oedipal. So our interpretation of this based on that Orestian model is definitely, and he developed it. Others have commented on it. I wrote a paper on it 20 years ago and looked at other authors who had also seen these parallels. You know, the idea of, you know, the soliloquy, you know, about the death, but what dreams may come, must give us pause, you know, considering whether dying is good or not. That comes right out of the Apology of Plato, which Oxford had in his collection. So, you know, you just see all these beautiful parallels where he's integrating this ancient mythic construction and images. And then I'll tell you, Chris, we were studying the Orestia in a class I was taking. 10 weeks to read the entire trilogy and several translations. Same time they did a production of Macbeth at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I was shocked over and over again by the parallels. And I ran home and I wrote 12 different parallel qualities, the bird allegories, the three sisters as a chorus, all the different things that were similar in so many ways. And then I wrote a paper about it. It took me 6 months, but it's real. It's there. If you're studying down into those Greek texts, you'll find an amazing amount of material that just thrilled me. So if people are interested in this, all the articles that I wrote are available on the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship website. We have a publications page, and if people are interested, you can give them my email, and I will send them to an article that they might be interested in. I have a Journal of Scientific Exploration article from last summer, so 2003, a summer issue. Catherine Chilton also has an article in there, and I call it Shakespeare and the Greeks, A Century of Scholarly Neglect. And I point out the various parallels in a variety of plays, including The Winter's Tale and Much Ado and the other tragedies I mentioned. Oh, yeah, and Timon of Athens. So there's a number of reasons I think he was inspired by a number of Greek elements and wove them in this place as a Renaissance mimetic master. That was his craft. And then, of course, the Greeks had music, they had dance, everything that would have inspired him. 2,000 years later, he's reinventing it. Nobody's touched it since then.
And you know, even when you start looking at especially some of the rite, the ritual that happens inside of Shakespearean plays, a lot of the medicine that's used in there comes from Greek tradition, things like that. And it especially dawned on me just now the magical parts and the connection with John Dee and things like that happening, but pretty much concurrently at almost the same time, you know? So the idea of John Dee, literally reviving a lot of things like, the Emerald Tablets, stuff like that, and bringing about the alchemical, side of things into that world. It's pretty interesting even to consider those parallels between that.
Well, there are two scenes in Shakespeare that are exactly those alchemical, you know, miracle scenes. One of them is the resuscitation of Queen Thaisa by Lord Cerimon. He says, play music. Let's warm her. She's hypothermic and presumed dead. And then he does his magic. He warms her, and he describes the means by which he created this art. And it's such a beautiful scene and an exquisite expression of what really is great about medicine. He says, I learned from my reading, from my experience, you know, and it much pleased me more to be a student of this than to ever tie my reputation and my faith up in bags of gold. No, it's about this miracle. And then she rises up. It's a miraculous, incredible scene. And the other one, of course, is in The Winter's Tale with Queen Hermione coming back to life. But he, and then of course there's the divine scene in the Tempest, the marriage scene in the Tempest.
Yeah.
And there are other, you know, and ghostly scenes, of course, and they're holy in their own ways. So you've got supernaturalism penetrates Shakespeare's plays, both in a positive blessing sort of way and in the way of ghosts and curses, you know, you have it.
Yeah. And once again, even grabbing hold of what would have been a zeitgeist at that time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There was a huge move to spiritualism at that point. So even the interweaving of that, which was going on once again inside of the royal encampments, things like that, they all had their own private alchemists. They all had their own medicine men that traveled, things like that. So even the mixing of that shows the fact that probably not an average Joe, you know.
No, well, listen, the Earl of Oxford received two dedications, you know, from the surgeon, George Baker, that was the Queen's surgeon, okay? He also received a dedication from a book on Paracelsian medicine by John Hester, who was England's leading, pharmacist. And had a big operation down right along the banks of the Thames, you know. So his wife was an empiric practitioner like Helena.
Oh, wow.
And Helena's healing of the king was another sacred moment.
Yep.
Her speech is an incantation. When she says, in 3 days, you'll heal. And I wish I could give you that speech. It's a beautiful speech. It's a short passage. But in the true Paracelsian magical universe, she heals the fistula that no other physician can heal. And in 3 days, it's gone. And then, you know, she's elevated, and then Bertram's elevated, and then, you know, forced to marry her and all that because of her miraculous healing of the king. She gets this boon, you know, to choose her husband. There was a problem there. And of course, that's a rather autobiographical thing. So that his wife was an empiric practitioner known to heal the people in their neighborhood, was familiar with the herbal remedies and all these things and Paracelsus, and their books are dedicated number of them to her also. So they were vested in their knowledge of medicine in its most current phase. And of course, Oxford indeed did correspond. So I don't know much about their personal relationship, but within the family themselves, he was deeply interested in medical texts. And there's many hundreds of medical texts in Burleigh's library where Oxford lived for a decade.
That's kind of a rabbit hole that I now feel myself compelled to just root through is the connection between John Dee and Edward De Vere. Cause it dawns on me now that especially with his uncle being a publisher, things like that, they were probably in pretty tight cohort. Cause there weren't a whole lot of like publishers, so to say. It's not like it is nowadays where you could hop online and find 28 different places to have your book assembled and printed. You know, it was a pretty locked down industry at the time.
Well, the first book was published under the name of Shakespeare, the Venus and Adonis, was approved by the Archbishop, you know, of Canterbury.
Yep.
So from the very first name published with Shakespeare as the author, it achieved the highest level of approval. Okay, so how many editions of that were published? I mean, 10 or 15 in the next couple centuries, in the next couple decades.
Well, with that being said, in the last 10 minutes here. Let's get into this conspiracy, this quite literal conspiracy to continually obfuscate who Shakespeare is. Because once again, I do not think that when you shake the trees that enough monkeys fall out for the for the dialogue of who Shakespeare is to be Shakespeare. I don't think you're exactly right, Chris,
because the Folger Shakespeare Library that holds the most folios of any place in the world and has deep, deep archives of everything, you know, including Edward de Vere's Geneva Bible. They've recently remodeled an $80 million project. They've completely refashioned their exhibit. And there's nothing about the life of Will Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon. It's basically not there. What you have is a fancy case full of all their 80 copies of the first folios that they are so proud of. And there are still good research going on there, I'm certain, and good education programs and even excellent theater. But it is not a place where the life of Will Shakespeare is in any way an important visually available, featured. Dorothea Dickerman wrote an article about the new design of the Shakespeare. Basically, he says Will is nowhere to be seen. It's all about current editions and current productions and current interpretations and more. Nothing much about the man. Mostly about the words themselves and about the text.
Yeah, more of an arm for dialogue.
In terms of there's fewer Shakespeare classes taught at universities, and that's generally true. And humanities has contracted compared to STEM education. And so theater took a big hit during COVID. But I can tell you that it's made a big comeback in the last couple of years here in Ashland, Oregon. And Oregon Shakespeare Festival is putting on some fabulous shows this year. So I do believe we can revive the interest in this. And Shakespeare is a linchpin for hooking people in the right way because it's so relevant and it can be done so well in this film productions that are so good. And now for us, the documentaries that we've had created about that question. Two of them that are available free on Amazon Prime are Nothing is Truer Than Truth and Last Will and Testament. You can watch either of those for no fee at all. And Cheryl Egan Donovan, who's the producer of Nothing is Truer Than Truth, will be in Denver with us and speaking and promoting her latest project, All the World's a Stage. And she is going to oddly end with Sir Derek Jacobi and Richard Clifford to investigate the findings there and put them into her new film. So this is a very exciting time for us. We have knights on our side. We have Sir Derek Jacobi and we have Sir Mark Rylance that are behind our little conspiracy, and we love that.
Well, and you know, once again, I choose to believe that because it's not like it is changing the equation of time, you know, which is a made up concept in and of itself. Like it's the only thing in physics made up is time. Even the idea of that seems to have less impact than the want to discover who Shakespeare actually is. And it's pretty fascinating to see once again the flails through which the entrenched society will go through to fight against this idea. When you logically start looking at things that once again, no completed manuscripts in the original author's hand. Once you start looking at what should be evidence in a court case, it just doesn't stack up. It stacks up to a whole bunch of circumstantial evidence.
I know, Chris. But it gets brutal. You know, Elizabeth Winkler, the author of the book I was mentioning earlier about Shakespeare was a Woman, gave it a public event with Sir Derek Jacobi at London Public Library. And this crazy guy, I'm not even going to mention his name, wrote a horrible letter to everybody. It got published and posted out there online and everything about how they should never have allowed this to happen, you know. And so then Roz Barber, who is one of our colleagues and writes with the Shakespearean Authors of Trust, she manages their website, and they're wonderful people. She writes a satiric commentary on his objection to this, and now he's trying to sue her in court for defamation of character. I mean, it's like these people are so disturbed and uncomfortable. I believe that they are ignorant and envious at the same time, which is a terrible combination. And they're arrogant, and they're arrogant about their special position. And the people they revered would, of course, not understood this, but there's new evidence. And there's new ways of approaching it. And I am an amateur at this. You know, I've been having fun with this for 20 years since I got free of medicine. And I still love and learn more all the time. And so I think it's got me hooked. And I think anybody that's willing to love Shakespeare, go for it. If you have a yen for Shakespeare, the Author's Your Question is a place where you can really find deep reading and wonderful occasions. And those of you that are really excited, come and join us at our conference in Denver. You can still sign up at the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship website for live streaming our conference, which then is available for a 30-day period of time after it gets posted on YouTube. So we'd be very happy to have any of you that are really curious about diving in with us. They could sign up for that. Some of those videos from that program will get posted free online later anyway.
I cannot wait. It's going to be a fantastic conference. I am greatly, greatly looking forward to it. Thank you so much for allowing Curious Realm the access to come out and cover this and to get you guys a little bit more attention. Because once again, it's one of those we have to be willing to question. If we're not willing to question, then science eventually becomes doctrine. And that's not what science is. You know, we're supposed to, it doesn't happen. Research doesn't happen in a vacuum. And the observation is when science starts, and there is more than one observation to show that the dude you know as William Shakespeare probably did not write these works. Yeah. So, look into that, folks. It's a fascinating, fascinating story and a fascinating puzzle of history that, I think, as an artist myself, as someone who's written poetry, someone who's penned music, things like that, I write under a nom de plume, sure, but I have a name there because I want people to know who wrote it, you know? It's one of those. I think Edward, if he wrote all of it, deserves all credit. And it may come down to royal families and the way they, maybe even estates, as we brought up with Catherine before. It may have been the fact of to reveal it later may have messed up something in some royal estate, you know.
No, there's a whole alternative theory. I believe Catherine is very, very well spoken in this regard. I reserve judgment on how that might go, but I can just see the queen saying, keep it quiet. Yeah. And that's the idea of sprezzatura, that you do this without acknowledging its source.
Yeah,
that it's a Castiglione expression of you know, noble largesse, and that you accomplish massive deeds and remain behind the curtain. Yeah. And I think that he liked that.
Yeah,
and I think that the family kept it going, and that Susan Vere's youngest daughter, you know, did this for her father, and without having to acknowledge that he was the actual author. There was no money in it for them, and there was a loss of reputation. If you were to have shown something in retrospect, that proves embarrassing, you know. So then people start lifting the bed covers. We don't have that.
yeah, exactly. Well, I want to thank you so much, Earl. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I cannot wait to meet you in person here in the next couple weeks. Everybody stay tuned, because we will be having official coverage from the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference coming up. That is actively, I've got the schedule right here. That is actively coming up on the 1st of October. Will be an entire episode about nothing but Shakespeare with all kinds of researchers. So stay tuned for that, folks. Earl, thank you so much for the time tonight. You take care.
See you in Denver, and I'll bring you some copies of my Greek articles.
Cannot wait. Man,
all right,
what an incredible conversation, folks. While you are online checking out everything from Earl Showerman, as well as the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share. When we come back from this quick break, we will be talking with our good friend and guest, the Reverend Michael J.S. Carter. We will be talking about angelic messages given to people by angels throughout time, specifically in the Bible, and how these messages relate to messages given to UFO and UAP experiencers, especially those who are abducted. So when we come back, we will be getting into angelic messages with Reverend Michael J.S. Carter right after this. The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying around through that. And also, thank you so much to WebWorks Wireless. They are one of our sponsors. They sponsor our live streams every week to our website. And if you are out there in the woods, folks, if you are looking for connection for your camp, if you're a mobile broadcaster like me and looking for live stream broadband anywhere that you are, stop on by and check out WebWorks Wireless. WebWorksWireless.com is your source for high-speed internet for all, no data limits, no capping, no credit checks, no contracts. I'm here to tell you, we have been using WebWorks Wireless since the beginning of Curious Realm, and they have been fantastic, folks. Stop on by and check them out. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Michael J.S. Carter. He is the author of Initiation as well as Enlightenment. Enlightenment is a great, great collection of sermons and teachings that he has compiled over his many years as a reverend. You may have seen Michael J.S. Carter on many talking head shows such as Ancient Aliens. Welcome back to the show, Reverend Carter. How are you doing?
Hey, Chris. It's always a pleasure, as you know.
Always great.
Here we are in the last quarter of the year, we got three more months.
Yep.
And it's gone by.
It's zooming by.
You know, I'm looking at holidays. That's how I kind of measure my life. Some people in coffee spoons, but I'm doing it in with these holidays in the church year. And so we got Thanksgiving.
Yep.
And Christmas. And boom, 2025.
And that's it. Yeah. So it's rapidly approaching. And, you know, what's interesting is the topic for tonight, angels, messages.
Yes, yes, yes,
those,
yes, yes.
Those were things that were always rapidly approaching as well. It was never, whenever God sent an angel, it wasn't for a long overarching plan. You know, it was, 30 years from now, yeah, we're going to be looking at this. It was a case of extreme unction. Angels were, are intermediaries with the other realm, with God as we know it. The name itself means messenger.
Yes. I think in Hebrew it's Malak. I think in Hebrew, I forget what it is in Greek, but, yeah. And what's interesting, and I'm not just going to come at this from a UFO point of view, but, you know, we're never told where they're from or what they look like, at least for the most part. We just know that they can pop up and they come with a message. They deliver that message and they get out of there. And so it brings me to this, the synchronicity. I like maybe twice a year I get a massage. I wish I could do it more, but that's just the way it is right now. And there's a woman, masseuse, who I go to, who's very skilled and very good. And she is a person of faith. She is a little more evangelical than I am. Well, a lot more because I'm not. And I, you know, certain things I would say I couldn't bring up because I just didn't want to. And plus, I mean, what are you going to bring up? I'm trying to get a massage.
Yeah.
So she says to me, I need to tell you something. First of all, she reminded me that she did watch Ancient Aliens. And she said, I need to tell you something. It'll probably take a few minutes and I will make up for it at the end of this session because I have some free time, which I thought was classy and fair.
All right.
So she says, I want to tell you about an angel encounter. Now, remember, this is less than a week ago. Okay.
Yeah.
So I said, well, yeah. Okay. She's in an airport. She's been in a dysfunctional relationship. I don't even know if she told me where, but she's in a dysfunctional relationship with this guy. And they're at the airport and he dumps her. He breaks up with her at the airport and he leaves. She's never been on a plane. She's never really been out of the area. And she's starting to hyperventilate and panic. And she just said, Michael, it was just a terrible relationship. And I just couldn't go. And I broke up and I got back. And she said, I'm there and I'm hyperventilating because I don't have any money. And I missed my flight. She says, I wound up missing my flight. I said, oh, my goodness. Wow. She said, so I'm breathing. I feel like I'm going to cry. And she says, I look up and walking like down, just down this ramp towards her, you know, where everybody's waiting for their flight, is a guy. She said he was about 6'5". He was broad shouldered. She said she noticed, though, later that he did not have a name where his name should have been. She said he had curly hair hanging out from underneath the hat that they wear. She said, you know, most of airline folks, they're short haired for the most part. She said he had brown curls. He was very fair, big brown eyes. And he walked over to her and said, I'm here to get you to your flight. And she said, I couldn't speak. She said, I could not utter a word. She said, I just could not speak. Wow. She said, I was grateful, but I could. And he just kept smiling at her. And he took her. She said, he placed his hand in the small of my back. She said, now, when he was walking down, I said, did anybody else see this gentleman? She said, oh, yeah. And they just looked. People just looked at him and made a way like a sea was parting.
Wow.
She said, I never even saw her. He came. He said to her, she said he spoke in a weird way, almost archaic, because when he was, you know, touched her back and he said, follow me. He took her papers, whatever the documents that she had, and he said, follow me. And she said she still could not speak. And he kept looking at her and smiling at her. She said he was gorgeous. And he said something like, his sentence structure was, hold on, just let me. Is it not? Do you agree that it is not very confusing in these places? She said, that was a weird way of phrasing that saying. I said, yeah. And she said, they walked to this gate and he said, you are here. I'm going to leave you now. Your dad will be waiting for you. Here is your ticket. Your gate is over there. And he said, have a safe trip. And she said she watched him walk away and then he simply vanished.
What?
She said that wow. She did not see him turn a corner. What? He just walked away. And she said that she noticed again, he did not have a thing on a name tag, but she said to herself, how did he know my father was even waiting for me? And so she had a very contempt. It was a conflicting, dysfunctional relationship with her dad. She said when she got home, her dad kept saying, when she got off the plane, her dad kept saying, "What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?" And they never got along. And she said it was almost as if she said, "I just felt so happy. I just felt so peaceful." And she said, "I'm okay." She said, "I just didn't even want to engage his negativity." And she said, after a while, he left her alone and stopped asking questions. When she got home, her mom asked the same thing. "Why are you so happy after what you've gone through?" And
yeah.
She said, "Mom, everything is okay." And her mom let it go. And that was the story. She said, "Michael, I've been wanting to tell you that for years."
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That is a remarkable story. And
yeah.
And one that, you know, when you begin to look at the appearances of angels in the Bible.
Yes.
The way that angels make their appearance, which is, you know, much, much like with Zechariah, where he's praying and then suddenly there's an angel and it's like, "Don't be afraid." It's always very interesting that "don't be afraid"
happened to me with the reptilian being that I saw. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's I guess they're so used to, the word in Greek is angelos, Malak in Hebrew. And so I guess they're just so used to that, especially depending on how they show up to you, I would imagine. But, you know, what is it? Hebrews 13:2, you know, be careful, you know, when you're dealing with strangers, because some of us have entertained angels unawares. I have two angel stories, but again, they're not tied to UFOs. The similarity is they're both homeless people. I was in New York City. You know, I lived there many, 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 many years, and about 27 years to be exact. And one morning, I forget where I was going, but I was downtown in the 20s, around 22nd and 5th. That was the subway stop. 23rd, actually. Okay. And it was real early in the morning. I forgot where I was going. I had an appointment. And, you know, there were people out, but not a lot. And I was crossing the street. But I must have been really focused or thinking about something, because there was a homeless guy sitting on the curb. Silver beard, you know, with this, he was stinky and that kind of thing. Loose fitting, dirty clothes. And he said to me, "Why the big frown?" And it startled me. And I said, "Oh, my goodness." I said, "Yeah, I'm just thinking about something." I said, "Thank you for waking me up from that." And I gave him some money. And he said, "Yeah, you know, no need to frown." And I took literally about 3 or 4 steps just to turn around to look at him and say, "Listen, thank you." He was gone. There was no way that he could have gotten up and taken his stuff and gone. A similar thing happened. I was right across from the public library on 40, I think it was like 40th and 5th. And it was a little more people in the street because it was, you know, it was a little later in the day. But there was a homeless man sitting in the middle of the sidewalk. And, you know, I went over and I gave him some money and we chatted for a bit. And I said, "If I'm going to come through here again, and I'm going to give you something again when I come back." And he said, "Sure." He said, "I appreciate it. Don't even worry about it." And I walked. And again, it may have been 3 steps. I just wanted to turn around and look at him and give him a smile. And he was gone. And it was just no physical way that he could have gathered up everything and be gone within that. And I don't know what it was, but the human mind, you want to make sense of it. I said that was an angel.
Yeah. 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 And you know, especially bearing that kind of message, the message of, you know, trying to ease your day.
Lift up the vibration.
It's fascinating when you start exploring that, when you start, especially the idea of lift up the vibration, the idea that, these angels are always surrounding us, always around us, as we are taught in Sunday school, as we're taught in the Bible.
Yes.
How much of that do you think has to do with frequency? Do you think that they are necessarily divine, so to speak, or perhaps an entity that lives between frequency?
I think that, well, first of all, that's a great question. I feel that they probably do live, in between frequencies. It's interesting that, you know, what did Jesus say? That, it's the sick that are in need of a physician, not the well. Mm. And so they come, it seems that when you need it, when you are maybe not at your best, when you're not at your highest, not all the time. I don't want to paint that kind of picture. But the first part of your question is what's the most intriguing, because as you and I know, if you admit that we live in a universe that's teeming with life, you know what I mean? Then yep. We're surrounded by life all the time. We may not always see it. If you go look at 1 John 4, the letter of John, chapter 4, when he's talking about spirits, how you need to test the spirit, to see if you can resonate with their message. Now, you know, the word spirit, a lot of people think it could be maybe like the archons and the Gnostic gospel, these energy sure. beings, or it could be a disembodied spirit. He doesn't make that distinction in John. The author doesn't, but he's saying that these beings are all around you. And it's almost, you can think of a spirit as a being who can just ping in your reality and then ping out.
Yeah.
May not need a ship, but just can be in. And you know, again, this is in the Bible. I'm not making this up. Mm. And John is saying you got to test these spirits, which means he's acknowledging that there are spirits, that there are other sentient, conscious beings around us all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reason I bring up that idea of them living in the world in between, I guess, is because the first real reference that we get of an other than let us make man in our image, the imperial we and us mm-hmm. used in the beginnings of creation, depending on which story you're reading, story one or story two, the two yes. that are back to back. But right after that is when man is exiled from the garden. And that's when we first hear of angel. That's the first time where it's like, there will be a cherub with a flaming sword. Mm-hmm. Uriel, most people, attribute to being that angel, that is guarding the way to the path to Eden. But it's kind of like the angel was used as a barrier, as a means by which to keep us out of the promised land and a way to kind of, exile us from that promise that we broke fully, you know?
I mean, if we put it in the context of that, that part of the story in Genesis, we're looking at the Elohim who are keeping Adam and Eve from having knowledge which they feel they should not have and are not ready for, because Genesis 3 all the way up to 11 is the Elohim trying to get a handle on human beings.
Yeah.
No, we don't want them too smart. You know, we just want them, be conscious enough to keep working for us, but not smart enough to know that they're naked. And of course, when you get into Genesis 11, it really expounds on it, because it's the story of, you know, it doesn't make sense the way we've been taught it, that the Elohim, but we were taught God, is mad at them because they're violating building codes. Which doesn't make sense at all, because they built something too high.
Yeah.
That, and that's that interpretation of that story. But many times, and I would say more often than not, they are coming when you need them.
Yes.
Well, you know, and they're coming with either they're coming with a message, or they're coming, as we saw, as we see in Daniel in the lion's den, as we see in the book of Acts when Peter is imprisoned and you know, the walls crumble and he gets let out. They come when Paul's on his way to, obviously when he's on his way to Rome, you know, on the shipwreck. So they are coming, for the most part, with a message, and they seem to have some type of concern, and I would even go so far as to say care, for human beings. Again, not all of the time. So it's interesting when and how they show up, and basically they're messengers. And they must have looked very human, because if you remember the story in the book of Acts, not all of them, but we don't know. But, you know, when Barnabas and Paul are walking through the square and some people bow down to them and say, you know, and thinking they're angels, and they say, no, get up, rise, we're men like you.
Yep.
There must have been something about them that the other people said, these are angels. Mm. Which I find that fascinating. I also find it fascinating because Paul and Barnabas had the wherewithal to do that. And when you look at these other stories in the First Testament and mostly First Testament, they don't have time to say, look, no, I'm not a God.
Yeah.
Pull yourself together. They come, they deliver their message, and they leave.
Yeah.
They leave.
Yeah. It's normally a harried encounter. If dinner is involved, it's never completed.
Yes.
Like they sit down to dinner. It's almost like Christ's appearance on the road to Emmaus. As soon as he breaks the bread, he's gone, and they realize, right. Whoa, wait a minute. This was Jesus we were with, not just some stranger.
Right.
You know?
And sometimes, as you said, especially in the First Testament, you know, it's not till after they leave that person may not have been who we thought it was.
Yeah.
But the other thing that's as intriguing is that they do eat.
Yeah.
You know, they do eat. So that their digestive systems or what have you. When we look at Abraham, he's following the hospitality customs. Go, Sarah, get the fatted lamb. Let's make some cakes. Let's feed folk.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, Yahweh, who probably looked more dragon-like than more human. But, you know, he loves the smell of the food, of the meat, which is always interesting when people argue that this is God. And you're like, well, does God love, you know, virgin girls? He loves, and he loves gold and silver, and he loves the meat.
Well, we know Zeus did.
We do, but Zeus was not the creator of the universe.
No, he was the mountain god.
He was the highest of the pantheon of the Greeks.
Yeah.
But that's different from like what Plato calls the source.
True.
And Plato acknowledged Zeus, but for Plato, there was something that he called, you know, when he talked about a fractalized universe, because Plato talked about the gods as well as a supreme. So
that's
for
right.
Plato, Zeus was, you know, he drank, he got drunk, he got angry.
Yeah.
He made love, you know, they were called the Titans back then.
Yeah.
So and there's that differentiation between the source, this non-anthropomorphic kind of energy, and the gods, they both exist.
That is a really good point, especially when talking about, well, Genesis and the beginning and the time before time. And, you know, let us make,
that's what Plato talks about.
Let us begin the universe, the whole idea of the prime mover. And that being separate from the angels.
Yeah.
And
there's that hierarchy.
Yeah.
And again, if we look at it as messenger, because that way, because when you, you know, otherwise you get that whole kind of religious take to it. They're holier than thou and, yep, and what have you, because I will tell you this, I will never say that angels don't have wings, but I think at the beginning, our ancestors were trying to tell us that these beings could fly. Mm. Thus the wings on them.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the idea of, coming from somewhere higher than you.
Yes.
You know, yes. That concept philosophically.
Yeah. So it's fascinating. And to me, it's so clear now, but then I couldn't see. But I remember Dr. Barry Downing saying that, you know, if you put the word wherever you see angel, if you put E.T., the Bible makes much more sense.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. If you put it wherever you see the word angel, just scratch it and put extraterrestrial.
Now let's explore that for a minute, because quite honestly, when you begin looking at the experiences of abductees, people like yourself, people like Sev Talk, people like Kathleen Martin, frequently one of the first things to come through the mind speak channel is don't be afraid.
Yes. Yes.
And it's interesting because once again, that is quite literally the first words, that you will just about hear from any angel is don't be afraid.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they have to know, because if this is their gig, that we are sending messages, we are giving and receiving messages, they probably see many human beings. And, you know, I'm here to tell you, it's that fight or flight, because they just ping in and out. Well, and here Zachariah is having a conversation.
Yeah.
And there are some stories where they can calm you down. I wish they had done that with me, and then you can actually interact more. But yeah. Yeah, because they probably know that kind of energy they have is powerful, it's fearsome, it's awesome. And human beings, especially back then, but probably, I mean, obviously now too. That's the first thing. This is otherworldly power. It's the mysterium tremendum.
Yeah.
You know, and here they have that. That's why when people say to me, I wish what happened to you would happen to me, or why don't they come see me? I say you need to be careful what you ask for, because this is not Mickey Mouse. This is not about me trying to think I'm special or anything like that. But you have to be careful because it's traumatic. And some people never really ever get over it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And that's just it. You know, even when it comes to the religious, Reverend. There are people who never get over their religious experience when it happens to them. And it can frighten people away from faith. It can bring people closer to faith. And it's really interesting to see how that phenomenologically changes a person.
Well, and it does. It does.
And it's interesting how it, cause I don't think without my experience of bilocation and being in that presence of true joy and love that happened to me on those couple of occasions that it did, I don't think I would be a run to the danger person like I am. I don't think that my response to things like that, when emergencies happen, I don't think that I would be a run to the way I am.
Right. That, because the natural thing is to go, whoa,
to go help.
Yeah.
The natural thing for me is to run to that point of love and care and go help. Doesn't matter if it's my own danger.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So yeah, it's interesting.
It is interesting. I was just thinking of, okay. My mother-in-law, we were on vacation, and my mother, two weeks ago, and my mother-in-law fell down and broke her hip.
Oh, no.
She's okay at 87. She dodged it. So, you know, my ex, I mean, my wife has siblings closer to her mom in Florida. Obviously, my wife is up here, but they try to share those duties when she gets sick. So mm-hmm. she was there, then she came back. Now she's leaving Monday for about a week. So I won't see her after Sunday, probably for about a week, 10 days, because she's going to be in Florida. I'm going to be in Michigan. And, you know,
yeah.
The point I'm trying to make is I have a hard time after all these many years when I'm home alone. It's a difficult yeah. time for me.
Yeah.
Because of my contact experiences. And I will close the blinds as if that's going to keep them out. And I don't want them to be out, but it's just that fear. And, you know, the same thing I'm longing for is the same thing I fear. And, you know, I close the blinds, but it's tough because I'm waiting for them to show up. And, you know, that's what, going back to what I was saying with people who I wish it would happen to me. And I think I'm a fairly healthy individual emotionally and what have you.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking about this whole week coming up.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to be here by myself and late at night. And, you know, I mean, I get through it. I've been doing this for years, but I still have that. I don't want to call it a scar, but I still have the post-traumatic yeah. stress of it.
Well,
and I think these beings help me. I really do.
I was going to ask you about that and ask to loop back to the beginning of the conversation, because when we first started talking about angels and angel experiences, you brought up a reptilian experience.
Yeah. And yeah. That was the guy who said, you know, he said, don't be afraid, which looking back now, well, that's easy, you know, for you to say, look at you, look how you, you know, I'm being facetious, but sure. yeah, you know, it's easy to say that. He just walked through my wall and touched me.
Yeah.
But even if it was the Nordic who healed my blood clot, or the gray people who kind of jump-started all this. It, you know, they didn't say don't be afraid. If they did, I didn't hear them.
Mm.
You know, that's the trauma of it for me now. And I will say that this has changed my life for the better. But, you know, it's that your reality is shattered, and you know that anything can happen at any time.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just interesting. It's
yeah.
just interesting. Yeah,
well,
yeah, yeah. It's interesting too. My wife is not an experiencer that she or I know of, but I've never been with someone that there are more nightlights in the house than I can count. There are nightlights all in, and sometimes I have to take them out because I'm saying if I see their blue light,
yeah.
if they're coming, that gives me a heads up. But it's just so there's lights all around this house that you plug in a socket. And I'm thinking to myself, for someone who says they're not an experiencer, I've just never seen that many lights. But I had to take one off the other day because the house is bigger than I've ever lived in. And it's not huge, but I can see, like, if I want to walk down the hall there, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting week for me. Beginning this Sunday. Keep me in your prayers.
Well, you're always in my prayers to begin with.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, especially
yeah.
knowing that you will be, because
yeah,
I know it can be hard. It can be hard because once again, you
freaks me out, man.
It's a PTSD situation, and
yes.
it's nothing that you should ever be ashamed of, that you're triggered from.
Well, I'm glad you said
were,
that because
you
I've
were taken
started-
without your consent.
Or that I know of, you know,
yeah.
All I know is that I thank you for reminding me of that, because I never really, I just started telling people that on podcasts, you know,
yeah.
in context, this
yeah.
kind of talk. I just didn't blurt out, oh, guess what? I'm afraid to be at home by myself at night.
Yeah.
Probably the past 18 months, maybe. I just never brought it up.
Well, but it's something that's very pertinent. You know, typically, it's when I would point at all the books behind me and mention all the books that I have that are autographed by people. You think you want this experience. Like the book may end like a Disney movie, but it also starts like one, which means the first 5 minutes is not good for somebody involved. You know, and these experiences, whether they're cryptid encounters, paranormal encounters, encounters of the third and fourth kind, even of the second kind sometimes, when it comes to UFO, UAP, sometimes even just the witnessing of that event can shock the system to a point
that's the best way to put it,
that you don't know how to process reality anymore.
It's the nervous system, you know. It's just my nervous system can be hyperventilate. It can be, you know, just I become more vigilant.
Hypervigilance.
That's the word.
Hypervigilance.
And I become more vigilant. And when she's here or my daughter's here, I know they're in the house. Well, obviously, my wife would be right next to me. Or if my daughter's here, but now she's away at school, you know, she'd be down the hall. And then it's a whole other thing. Mm. But when she leaves on, because I've been visited out when I'm out of town.
Yeah.
You know, I have been visited when I was in Boston many, many years ago. This was early on. And and that's the thing. It's the suddenness of, and I use the word ping because that's what I heard people do. It's like they can ping in and out. And so maybe, you know, if I see the light or something, that blue light that I usually see, I can in some way, shape or form, okay, I can brace. But sometimes they're just there. You know, you're asleep, or you think you're asleep, or you may just be awake like I was at the beginning, and I may turn over to get to go to the bathroom or whatever, and boom, there's somebody in my room. Your nervous system can't
unring that bell.
It's just a fight or flight kind of
thing. It is a fight or flight response. And, you know, the.
Like, even now, reliving it.
Yeah, I can
see that. I'm shallow breathing. Yeah.
I can see that. And, you know, it's hard. And it's hard to. It's nothing that you necessarily need to get past. It's something that you've got to kind of learn to coexist with, much like anxiety or panic or anything like that.
And all many years.
But with that being said, I was going to ask, you know, the suddenness that you bring up, because once again, whenever you look at angelic visitations in the Bible, it's normally like they just appeared out of nowhere, which is part of the don't be afraid. Like, hey, you know, this pretty large guy just appeared directly in front of you, or just approached with no sign, coming up the way,
things like that. I think probably the people around her probably kept her grounded, just knowing you weren't alone.
Sure.
It'd be different. I have a feeling it'd be a different story in a way, you know, if no one else was there for her. They give those stories, give hope.
Yes.
And because what's happening now, and you may or may not agree, is that it seems that the only legit, the only authentic narrative around contact is if it's David Grush talking about it, or the governor Gary Nolan talking about it. And I'm not dissing these brothers.
Yeah.
You know, when there are people having these encounters, ordinary people like you and I. And so if you control the narrative, you control the story. Yeah. And, you know, you're not seeing anymore like you did when Whitley was coming along or John Mack was talking about just everyday folk. Now it's got to be a fighter pilot.
Well, right? Now
it's got to be a military intelligence person.
Now
those are the legit contacts. Well, and I'm concerned about that.
Oh, what concerns me even more is the casting of shadows on events like Betty and Barney Hill. you know,
where Dr. Greer did.
Where Dr. Greer was like, this was my labs. It's like, yo, you are throwing a whole new level of shade over quite literally a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And this was one of the primary cases of that abduction phenomena. So
and he had no evidence to back this up whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so that's concerning.
To me it's very much a spike driven within a community that's there to divide a community. Mm-hmm. Because once again, controlling a dialogue.
That to me was concerning. I didn't mean to interrupt. No. If I control the narrative, I control the reaction.
Yeah.
And so that's just what's concerning to me. I know there are other experiencers who voiced it, that it seems like unless it's, you know, Brother Nolan says he's an experiencer.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are others, but it's only when these people say that's the only legit kind of story where there are other people. Thousands, millions probably, and you don't hear from them.
Exactly.
So that's why we need shows like yours and other people's shows to say, wait a minute, this is not just the government doesn't have a monopoly on these stories.
Yeah.
These are stories of the people. Well, they're not visiting. They're not. I would be concerned if extraterrestrial life, the only people they were visiting would be high ranking generals. I'd be very concerned.
Same. Especially when it comes to messages, when it comes to communication. I'd like to explore for a few minutes because we've got you for about another 15 minutes or so. And in that time, I'd like to explore this, the concept of consent, fiat. As it's said by Mary in the Bible with the angel Gabriel, whenever the angel comes to her and pronounces that, you know, you may very well carry the Christ child and the future of humanity, and she has to give her consent. A minute ago, we were discussing the idea of consent when it comes to experience, when it comes to abduction. And the idea of whether your consent was given or not, especially even to the appearance of something, you know, there are a lot of deep, hard right Christians here, Reverend, that will take the demonic route, things like that when it comes to these experiences. Do you believe your experience is reptilian, gray or other, are malignant in any way? Have you ever experienced that?
I don't. And I have had questionable experiences with entities that I weren't sure that maybe wanted to sing Imagine or Kumbaya with me. That's a great question, but you usually do that anyway. And you did it to me just now. I want to be careful of putting a 21st Absolutely. Century overlay on this, you know, and I'm not talking about being woke or anything like that. And I don't particularly think anything is wrong with the word with the way Buddha talked about it.
Yeah.
But what I am saying is, if these beings are our creators, you know, then they don't need our permission, you know, and I think we have to grow up. My wife took our dog to the vet today and they had to take blood and a couple other things. And he kind of snapped at the vet and he didn't ask our permission.
Yeah.
He didn't ask our permission. Now we know he's okay. We got the blood work and what have you.
Yeah.
And I get it. I get that, but it's kind of like a 21st century thing where you can't take me beyond my, who are you that we can't?
Yeah.
Who are you that you are that important
and
that I have to contact you and say, hey, we're going to come visit you tonight. And are you going to be home or are you going to watch? You watching Monday Night Football? What's a good time?
Well,
I'm not sure that that's what the universe is doing.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of the idea of what's an hour to God. You know, like we defined time, you know, not God. That is totally a man-made. It's the only scientific thing that's utterly made up is time.
I hear you. And I know, you know, I feel on some level, and I may be wrong, on some metaphysical level, maybe I have a contract. Maybe between lives.
Sure.
This was part of, you know, but I can't prove that. But that's different from saying, you cannot take me without my permission. You know, it didn't work in Gaza. Okay?
Yeah.
They didn't say, well, wait a minute, that Israel, you can't take me without. No, it's not realistic.
Yeah.
It's not realistic. When people kidnap you or shoot you or whatever. So why would you expect that from these beings? You wouldn't expect it from a human being. If a human being pulled a gun on you and said, get in the car, you're not going to argue. You didn't ask my permission.
Yeah.
You're going to try to figure out a way to get away. Or you're in a situation. But you're not going to say, well, you don't have my permission to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, precisely. And the idea of like, who are you to appear in my house? You don't have permission to do that. Well, who are you to command them?
I just don't think it's realistic. It would be nice.
Yeah.
Oh, Michael, you're busy tonight. I know Dawn, she'll be back next week. Why don't we come back next week?
Yeah.
I know you got that trauma going on. No one's going to do that.
Yeah.
And I don't expect anyone to do that. And so, you know, the agency is something we can talk about, but you know, but it gets more into the deeper philosophical discussion about how much agency we have, destiny, free will. But these beings came and they did what they needed to do with me over a span of years, healed a blood clot, got me out of some jams, changed the energy that was coming out of my hands from whatever Reiki was to whatever it is now. These were good things to me. I opened myself. Now, I did my own work because I was growing. I had a spiritual path before they came. They kind of accelerated it. But to think for one reason that the universe is, I have that much of an intimate relationship that the beings who live there are going to get my permission before they come. I just don't think that's realistic.
That is a very cogent point to make.
Yeah.
And that's
when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, whether you believe the story or not, the adversary didn't say, hey, Jesus didn't say, hey, man, you know, you need to, why don't you just give me a call before you get here?
Yeah. No.
You know?
And that's it.
They have to stop.
I had to ask because, of course,
I'm talking about people.
Great
question.
It's one of those, like, I've seen in numerous communities. There was a community that I belonged to not long ago where they were talking about these horrible demonic things that a Sasquatch had done to people during an attack. And I was like, okay, now hold on. We're now judging a Sasquatch by human standard.
Yeah.
That's like saying, you know, did a bear break the human moral imperative? You know, I don't know if philosophically we can even go down that route, because is a bear even bound by our moral imperative?
Yeah,
it's not a human.
Guess what, brother? And you know this. You're a minister. Once a minister, always a minister. We're not even bound to our own laws.
Yeah.
Human beings, we make these lofty laws and we don't even follow. So come on.
So yeah.
We don't even follow. I wish we would. I wish I did all the time, but come on.
But I just wanted to ask, you know, especially when it comes
to a great question.
People have to understand that yes, you may very well be able to use the agency of Christ to bring healing and power unto yourself to dispel an appearance whenever something happens, something like that. But to say that you will be able to prevent it from happening,
I don't think that's possible.
I don't know. I don't know that that's possible.
Either. You know, even Buddha was tempted by these demons, and yes. Lao Tzu. You read all. You go into Native American lore and what have you. I will say this. One evening, many, many years ago, because see, part of my trauma is not just that they came, but they were coming like you know, several times a month.
Yeah.
You know, and then maybe a couple of years would go by then. Anyway, I was curious about evangelical or more conservative Christian brothers and sisters saying, if you say I'm surrounded by the Christ consciousness or the white light of Christ or whatever the wording, that these beings would back off. And I swear to you, there were a time when I was like a frequent flyer. There were just people visiting things, people. And there was one entity, I couldn't see it, but I felt it. I wouldn't even open my eyes. It was just a very heavy, dark, for lack of a better word. I don't like to use that word all the time for negativity, but you got my point. Energy. And it was around my bed. And mentally, I said repeatedly, like a mantra, I'm surrounded by the white light of Christ.
Yeah.
I'm surrounded by Christ consciousness. I'm trying. And I swear to you, a voice in my head said, yeah, right. But it left. It left.
Yeah.
You could mock me. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. But you left.
Yeah.
So I can say there must have been some truth to that. Now, some people can say, well, I said the same thing and they took me anyway. That has happened, I'm sure.
Yep.
But I was so scared because it wasn't like an extraterrestrial energy or need. It was the reptilian didn't have that kind of energy. Wow. But I remember that. And I don't talk about it all the time because I know people run with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember that. And I remember I got to say something. And this is getting out of hand. And I remember it was, yeah, right. But the energy cleared.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that that is an important place for us to come to as we close this episode out is the idea that, you know, you may not be in control of when and where and how the encounter happens to you. But you are in control of the processing in post. You know, you are in control of how you process it, how you, because even as you're saying, your experiences continue to this day. They are not something that you grandly look forward to on a Wednesday night
or hope happen.
You know?
The last one I had was in 2019, and I'm sure they'll come again. It was a praying mantis being. I told you that story. Mm-hmm. But I don't seek this out, brother. I really don't. It has helped people, and I think that I'm helping people, but it comes at a cost, at least with me. And like I said, on Sunday night when my wife leaves for a week, it's going to be interesting around my house. I'm leaving Thursday. So if I can get through Thursday, I'm leaving to go to Michigan. Now, like I said, they have come to hotel rooms, but they haven't recently. But yeah, and that's you know, you cross those bridges when you get there. But, you know, and I'm like you said, and you reminded me it was very powerful. It's not something like, oh, come on, Michael, get over it or whatever. Mm. But it's just part of that. It's just part of the post-traumatic stress.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they haven't hurt me. You know, it's just that, you know, that. Well, you know, it's just, boy, it's just the suddenness. Listen, when you go to bed tonight, and if the lights were out, and I'm a human shape, I'm an anthropomorphic shape, but if you woke up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and I'm saying, hey, Chris, you're going to freak.
Yeah.
You know, you may even hurt me. Maybe that's why they paralyze you, so you don't get up and go, ah! But, you know, it'll freak you out. It did me.
Well, and you know, that's just it. I don't think that whether you're talking alien experience, whether you're talking angelic experience. I don't think that either one comes without that level of freak out, Reverend.
I wish I was like, you know, I got some books over here. Now, granted, these people look more Nordic. But I wish they would calm me, Michael. You know, like some people say, well, they touched me or I could feel. Then I could talk because Lord knows I have questions and what have you. But the only time I trained myself, this is, I know we got about 2 minutes.
It's all right.
I felt like I did because that used to bug me. I said, Michael, you should not be afraid. And I would meditate and I would just, and if they came, I just lost it. But one time they came to me in a dream, but it was the type of dream where it wasn't really a dream because everything was in real time, the same way it is in the dream. My bed was there. My, you know, my coffee pot was over there. My coat was over there. So in the dream, I'm praying. And I got my arms around these two grays. They're kind of like my height. And we're laughing and joking. And they walk me out of my hall, down my hall in my old apartment. So in the dream, I didn't freak out. In the dream, we were like holding, you know, arms around each other, that kind of thing. Because I kept saying to myself, I want to be able, when they come again, I want to be able to just stand my ground and say, you know, greetings. What's going on?
Yeah.
So I did it in my dream, but in real life, that goes out the window. That goes out the window, and I don't know whether they paralyzed me because of that. Because I've heard stories of people going upside their heads with something, the little gray people hitting them and whatever. But I can do it in the dream. And it was real because, like I said, everything, you know, and that's why I knew it was real time. They made it seem like a dream because, you know, in dreams, things are distorted and what have you.
Yeah, time but dilation.
When they come, that calm serenity, hey, brother, what's going on? I don't have that.
Wow.
And they don't seem to want to give me that. They don't say, hey, Michael, you got to dial this back. We've been doing this a while. They don't say that. And so, you know, my heart feels like, because even now, you know, just talking about it, I have
Well, and once again, the that close experience with the divine, and I would call an experience with ET or paranormal experience with the divine.
I would too.
You are touching another realm, another vibrational part of our reality. And consent or no consent, when you get to participate in that, when you get to align with that, that is a blessed and beautiful moment. So
I think so. And you know, consent, maybe I did give consent and don't remember it.
Maybe
I did it between lives. But I never thought about that, and I'm not suing them.
Yeah.
You know, what am I going to do? You did it. And I think people have to realize that you're not in control. I don't care whether it's ET or just anything, near death experience, paranormal, just everyday life. You're not in control. And I think to
That's
expect
right.
that is to not be spiritually mature.
That is the going out. That is hands down one of the best points to make, period, when it comes to this, Reverend.
Yeah, I have so much control that I can even control. No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Just be quiet and go for the ride.
And you know, much like the prophets of old who ran across angels, those people who had the angelic experience, I think those having the modern abduction experience are in the same realm.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Even Moses, you know, Moses dealing with Yahweh. Moses, you know, stuttering and I don't want to do this. Yahweh said, "You're going to do it."
Yeah,
you're going to do it. He didn't say, "Well, I didn't give you consent."
Yeah, yeah. There wasn't a whole lot of consent with Jonah being swallowed by a whale and spat up.
There's no consent with Travis. There's no consent with Betty and Barney. There's no consent with you. Come on. There's not consent. You're not that important.
And
you're not in control.
That is something that we have said many, many times when it comes to demonology, angels, aliens, things like that, they are playing by a different set of rules than by what we are bound.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Wow. Fantastic conversation.
Absolutely. Always. Michael, thank you so much for your time. Let everybody know where they can go, of course, other than the Curious Realm store, where they can go to buy your books, where they can go to keep up with you. You're, of course, appearing in Michigan.
Go on Amazon. Go on Michigan, UFO Con, Michigan. It's the weekend of the 19th. 19, 20, 21, 22, Lake Houghton, Michigan. I'll be speaking. My talk is entitled Sacred Texts and Disclosure. There's a new Ancient Aliens episode that will come out called The Teachers, but you may never be sure. And I don't know when they're going to air that, but I'll keep you posted. And I want to thank you guys, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in. Buy my books. If you want to get in touch with me, just MichaelJSCarter@gmail.com. No Reverend on the front, just MichaelJSCarter@gmail. I will respond. I promise you. My Facebook page, my fan page is Reverend Michael J. Carter.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, Reverend, thank you so much for the time as always.
Brother, let's do it again.
Always a pleasure.
Do it again.
I'll be sharing links, all that kind of good stuff. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. Okay. While you are online getting your hands on all of the books from Michael J.S. Carter there at curiousrealm.com/store, folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Research. Curious Research is our new endeavor to bring the world of paranormal investigation together with scientific endeavor. So stop on by and check that out. CuriousResearch.org is the website. That's where you can get our all new field observation and encounter log if you are out in the field doing paranormal work, things like that. Get all of your data ready to shake hands with science, folks. So thank you so much, as always, everybody, for tuning in. It is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation possible. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.